Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have our second installment of our special year-end awards from the Three Martini Lunch. We began that on Monday. Today is the second of six installments, and our three martinis today are Sorry to See You Go, Rising Political Star, and Political Figure Fading into Oblivion. Each of us will have their winners in each of those categories. Jim, you get to go first, and we start with the somber category of Sorry to See You Go.
There are obviously a lot of prominent, influential, and important figures who died in the past year, Greg. There was certainly no shortage of competition for this title, but it kind of seemed appropriate, considering how you and I got the idea for doing this from watching the McLaughlin Group, to say farewell to John McLaughlin. Longtime political figure who, very early in the 1980s, or maybe in the late 70s, started the McLaughlin Group. It was kind of an attempt to energize and revitalize political discussion on television, and ended up becoming extremely influential, not just all the sheer number of big-name political writers and journalists and columnists who ended up coming in as panelists. I think it's it became a very influential show. And when he, you know, passed away, they decided to kind of retire the concept of the show. When you hear, you know, issue one, you obviously first of all, you think of Dana Carvey's impression of him, which almost as distinctive and famous as John McLaughlin himself. The McLaughlin Group gets blamed for a lot of the problems in today's television. The McLaughlin Group certainly had plenty of times of people shouting at each other, talking over each other, wrong, Eleanor, things like that. But there are two interesting things that I think were intriguing about the McLaughlin Group and that were not emulated by other political chat shows, and that I kind of feel like were forgotten. One is that every one of the people on that panel, Eleanor Clift, Pat Buchanan, Fred Barnes, Morton Kondracki, they all really knew their stuff. They were all serious writers, serious thinkers, well plugged in with good sources. Freddie the Beetle Bonds, you know, they all had a viewpoint. You all knew exactly where they were coming from, but they were very well informed and they're all pretty darn good at debating. I don't think they're actually, despite the reputation, there really wasn't that much name calling and yelling and sneering at each other. And the second thing, which, you know, most of the participants will tell you, in real life, most of them were friends, or at the very least were social and, you know, had Christmas parties together, and that there was this certain amiability. They were all pretty much happy warriors, willing to argue the heck out of a particular topic and be passionate about it and stand up for what they believed. But in the end, they didn't, you know, carry it over into contempt for each other or a seething, sneering, condescending tone. They all had and respected each other. And so I kind of feel like that was a classic and good element to what televised political discussion and coverage could be. I miss John McLaughlin, and I miss the tone and the style that he created, because you want to talk about a guy who kind of made politics genuinely fun instead of the forced march that it seems like these days. It's a great influence, and I think he will be enormously missed in the world of television and politics.
A very good choice for a number of reasons, almost all of which you laid out. I just love the fact that it was original. There's so much copycat going on, and whether it's cable news or elsewhere, and cable news, of course, was in its infancy when the McLaughlin Group started, but just a very unique approach to it. His personality kind of dominated. It became the caricature, like you said, on Saturday Night Live that was maybe larger than life, but and it's just sad to see it gone, and given the fact that we've blatantly ripped off his idea for these year-end awards, it's appropriate that he is recognized there. At the same time, I thought there were two obvious choices when it came to conservatism this year, and I assumed you would pick one of them, and now I'm stuck trying to decide which one to do, so I will do a quick ode to one and spend a little more time on the other. Quickly to Phyllis Schlafly, a very critical figure in the rise of the conservative movement, single-handedly spearheaded the effort to stop the ERA in the 1970s when she had no money and no internet to try and rally people. She just did it through grassroots work in the phones, other conservative organizations. A lot of people think she's the reason, primarily the reason, that the Republican Party is a pro-life party through the 1970s, when you had folks like the Fords and others who were tilting more towards the pro-choice side. And she played a critical role in that, and she stayed very active right up until the very end. I know a lot of conservatives weren't too excited about the fact that she was so enthusiastic for Donald Trump, although she ended up being right, that he was going to be the nominee, and she did not live to see him get elected president. But when you look at the total body of work of Phyllis Schlafly, I think that needs to be recognized. But the biggest name of the year, I think, in this category has to be Justice Antonin Scalia. We were all shocked and horrified to find out that he passed away in February while he was at that ranch in Texas. Nearly 30 years on the U.S. Supreme Court, appointed by Reagan in 1986. And a guy like Justice Scalia confirmed unanimously, which tells you just how different things are when it comes to judicial confirmation now. And not just conservative, but a brilliant legal mind who loved to spar with the lawyers. He would go to all sorts of different law schools, knowing that most of the students disagreed with him. And he would just engage in the debate and love to talk about the Constitution. He was passionate about it and why he was a textualist, as he liked to say it, and why this living Constitution thing to him was, I don't know what he said, judicial applesauce or argle bargle or one of those great terms that he would use in his decision. He was just a crystal clear thinker. And just to take away a point you said about John McLaughlin, he was also extremely collegial. One of his best friends in life was Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which you just don't think about when you think about how differently their judicial philosophies are. But a titan on the court, even liberal law figures said that afterwards, that his impact on the court will be known for a long time, and just a great personality as well. And so, as you and I said at the time, it's kind of one of the fundamental moments when we saw the real end of the Reagan era with the passing of Justice Scalia.
And arguably probably one of the most consequential news stories of the year was his passing and the battle that we saw over the Supreme Court. So excellent choice there, Greg. Everyone's going to be kind of a little upset with me for not picking that one, but I still like McLaughlin as a choice.
No, I think that was extraordinarily appropriate given our situation. But so as you said, this was a year. I mean, everybody knows 2016 was the Grim Reaper year, and in politics it was no different. So on to rising political star. Jim, who do you have for that?
It's an interesting competition. I think some people might have said, well, look, you got to give it to Trump. That he stands out as you know, somebody who everybody figured would not be a great influential figure in politics. And obviously he's the president-elect. But I went with this kind of a different one because I felt like Trump had been around for a while and been kind of in the periphery of politics for a long time. I went with Todd Young, who is going to be the next senator from Indiana. He beat the snot out of Evan Bayh, a late entrant into the Senate race out there. A lot of folks said, Bayh's in. This is a famous name in politics. This is an Indiana political dynasty. There's no way that that Young was, you know, was going to be able to overcome this. And in fact, not only did he beat him, he really made it look easy. Month by month, week by week, you could see Evan Bayh slipping. It was very clear that Evan Bayh had spent his time since he was last in the Senate enjoying being a high powerful lobbyist and influence peddler, and had never really planned on going back to Indiana. And it showed little things like, you know, whether he had residence in the state and things like that. Todd Young's record in the House, he fought over regulation, which is not one of those topics that's sexy or gets a lot of attention, but I think it's really important. And obviously, look, when you are the new senator from Indiana and the vice president is from Indiana, and obviously we know Mike Pence will be having a great deal of influence over policy in this administration, I think Todd Young is going to be a guy who will become a mover and shaker. A little ahead of schedule in light of who he is and what he's done, the skills he brings to the table, and other factors. So keep your eye on Todd Young. We may be talking about him in an important capacity for many years to come.
Yeah, good choice there. Todd Young, a member of the House for a number of years, but largely working quietly, as you mentioned, beat back a Tea Party challenger and Marlon Stutzman in the primary, much easier than folks had previously thought, and then beat Evan Bayh by nearly 10 points in a race that was considered neck and neck. Pence being on the national ticket probably didn't hurt, but it was just not the year for lobbyists to go back home between Bayh and Russ Feingold.
Yeah, you know, if only someone had told the Democrats that could be a flawed strategy. Oh, well.
Maybe next time. Hopefully not. All right. Jim, one of the exciting things about a new administration, particularly if it's a Republican administration, is some figures that haven't been in Washington before, at least not in any major capacity, and people coming in who have done some important things and impressive things at the state level. And the Trump cabinet, as we record this, is still coming together. Not all the positions have been filled out with the nominations. But one of them that has is administrator of the EPA. And the choice for that was Scott Pruitt. He is the attorney general of Oklahoma at the moment. And the fact that you're getting reactions from people like former Obama communications director Dan Pfeiffer calling Scott Pruitt an existential threat to the planet, and the Sierra Club saying it's like appointing an arsonist to put out fires. That's a pretty good sign when the left is that exercised about the whole thing. They call him a climate change denier or denialist because he isn't quite convinced that all these projections from climate change people, none of which that have actually come true, might not actually be all that clear. So he says there's not settled science there. He's also been a thorn in the side of the EPA and suing them a number of times, including things like the Waters of the United States rule, which the Obama EPA has now decided that a puddle in your backyard is a navigable body of water if it's close enough to a different body of water, and therefore the government has jurisdiction over it. I think a lot of people are going to like the fact that Scott Pruitt sees a constitutional boundary for the EPA that the outgoing administration did not see. And I think we're going to see some common sense at the EPA that we haven't seen in a very long time.
I like that choice, Greg. That is an excellent selection. Yeah, I mean, sometimes someone ends up in a, you know, look, there. When Christy Todd Whitman was in the Environmental Protection Agency, I don't think there was enormous attention paid to it. Obviously, there was a lot of other major issues going on in the early days of the Bush administration. But I kind of have a feeling that this is a topic that deserves more attention. The kind of the consequences of these regulations that are kind of put together in theory, and that those who have to live under them have haven't really thought through the full ramifications of them. I think there's a lot of good that can come from this, and I think the public could be well served by a more thorough and detailed public debate about these regulations and the real cost of them.
Yeah, so we could see Todd Young and Scott Pruitt working together since they've got a mutual interest in these regulations. The Clean Power Rule that's basically designed to kill the coal industry will be another one that'll be closely watched. Jim, our third and final category in this installment is political figure fading into oblivion.
I'll bet you can guess this one, Greg.
I think we're in agreement on this one.
All right. Finally, way to go, Nevada, way to go. Not that you got rid of him, but in the sense that he is departing from the stage. Harry Reid, you know, a bad, bad man who is just, it's not just that he's liberal. It's not just that he's partisan. We kind of figure that from a Senate Majority Leader. Out of all of his odious traits, maybe odious is the right word because he used to complain about how the tourists smell when they walk through the halls of the Capitol. I'm going to go say his sheer dishonesty, and lots of politicians lie. I think what obviously in a long history of them, one that stands out is his 2012 claim that Mitt Romney hadn't paid any taxes. Always pretty outlandish, always unsupported, or, you know, he was unwilling to put forth any real evidence of that. After the election, you know, people went to him and said, well, how could you say that? Isn't it pretty obvious that the story is like, well, it worked, didn't it? I mean, he wasn't even going to give the decency to feel regret about it or to say he shouldn't have said it. In his mind, if it works, if it gets you the results you want, then lying is okay. This is what makes him a particularly toxic figure on Capitol Hill. I guess I kind of want to say it to give credit to Mitt Romney, who upon Reid's departure, Romney got to say, good riddance, which, as we all know, is Mormon for much more crude terms that most of us would say to Harry Reid. So goodbye, Harry Reid. The Senate will be a better place without you, and American politics will be a better place with you there. We should also point out, by the way, Greg, that he's very proudly said he's not going back to Nevada. He will continue to live in the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C.
Well, hopefully it's on his own dime, although he's going to get a very nice pension, obviously. But I'm shocked that he's not going back to Searchlight. The whole grounding of his entire existence was Searchlight, but apparently it's not good enough for him to go back to. Fascinating. Yeah, Harry Reid is a guy who, like you said, it's his dishonesty, his nastiness. He got into an issue during this last campaign. I can't even remember what the issue was now, but it was basically accusing the Trump campaign of helping out a foreign power, kind of like Tom Cotton was accused of when he issued the open letter to Iran
about the Logan Act. Yes. The letter to foreign leaders. You're making foreign policy that way. Yeah.
And Tom Cotton.
I can do the same, Greg.
And yeah, and Tom Cotton says this is why Harry Reid is one of the worst people in the Senate, and even Democrats are excited to see him go. That could mean that Chuck Schumer provides a different challenge. He certainly won't be easy to deal with. But Harry Reid was nasty. I remember him basically saying the war was lost in Iraq before the surge and it wasn't worth our time. He ruled the Senate with an iron fist. He hardly ever allowed a Republican amendment and yet still managed to accuse the Republicans of being the obstructionists and holding things up in the Senate, which, of course, the press dutifully repeated. The way that he shepherded Obamacare, everything behind closed doors, ramming through reconciliation, then, of course, changing the rules on filibustering appointments, which is actually working out pretty well for Republicans here in the next few weeks.
Should we send a little bit of a thank you to say, he technically did get rid of the filibuster, thus eliminating the ability of Senate Democrats to stop the Trump nominees?
No.
You gotta say, all right, he did a little bit of good.
If his intent had actually been anywhere remotely in that direction, we might give him a little bit of credit, but no. Harry Reid deserves none. He's a despicable individual. I can think of nothing he contributed to Washington other than more rancor, more dishonesty, and eliciting more distrust from the American people. The fact that he was stuck in the minority for the last 4 years is fantastic. The fact that he will hopefully go away forever is joyous.
I like that. Excellent selection. It also says something that we both picked the same guy, doesn't it?
The only thing I'm going to miss about Harry Reid is we're not going to have the slogan anymore, but that's a trade I'm more than willing to make.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The world is better off without him in the Senate and without us making that complaint every couple of weeks.
Jim, more awards tomorrow. Talk to you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. And tune in again Wednesday for more year-end awards on the 3 Martini Lunch.